So it's a good start. Thank you very much for being here. My name is Jeff Burnside. And what we're doing now is transitioning from the first night, the gala. Boy, wasn't that exciting to see all of them up there? It was spectacular. Yesterday, as you know, the field trips, and of course the receptions last night. Now we're transitioning into the meat and potatoes of the conference. And I think it's nothing less than igniting the dialogue on the most important issues facing the planet. And I call them the most important stories on the planet. So Anna is, I consider her the nation's leading matchmaker between scientists and journalists. And if you've all gotten an email occasionally from Nancy about a topic, you know that it's something to pay attention to because you're going to be on the front page. Nancy's going to explain to you the process of what we will do this morning. Nancy?
Good morning, everybody. You are the hardcore, and we thank you all for getting up and joining us for this morning. This is going to be fast-paced to try to keep everybody awake. So we have a formula of 2-2. You're going to be hearing 2 minutes from each of our esteemed scientists and two questions from their partner journalists, and then we're going to open it up to you to ask whatever questions you want. So when Jeff and I were thinking about how to kick this off, we thought, okay, here we are, you know, in Miami, on the edge of the ocean, and let's bring in leading thinkers from the ocean marine science world to tell you what they're witnessing, because scientists are witnesses. Scientists see the future. And one of the biggest disconnects in our world today is that what scientists know is so far ahead of where society's at. And you guys are the bridges. So our challenge to our scientists this morning is two things. I just came back from Sweden, where one of the things that people say to each other all the time is, so tell me how it is really, really. So let's be real. And the other thing that we want you to do, because after all, these are journalists and they're here because they want a story, is tell us something we don't know.
So we're going to introduce the panel now. And I think we are really honored to have this collection not only of experts but of journalists. I consider to be these four journalists to be among the best in the country, if not the world. We are really, really pleased to have them there. Yes, that's you guys. Yes, that's right. No burden. You better be good. Ken Weiss, longtime reporter from the Los Angeles Times. You remember his spectacular series called Altered Oceans, won him the Pulitzer Prize. Andy Revkin, longtime climate reporter for the New York Times, now making the transition successfully from old media to new media, blogging with Dot Earth. Dirk Assendorf from Die Zeit, Germany's leading newspaper, spectacular reporter, did an amazing series on energy in Germany, which is really at the forefront of so many energy challenges. And Steve Kerwood, founder and host and executive producer of Living on Earth from NPR, from PRI. Nancy?
And next to me we have Becky Goldberg. Becky is Director of Ocean Sciences for Pew Environmental Group and also Lenfest. But also, Becky is one of the world's leading experts on aquaculture and is going to be talking to us a bit about sustainability at the grand scale for humans and all the other animals we share the oceans with. Next, we have Dee Boersma. Dee is from the University of Washington. Dee is a force, as you will soon see. And many of you may have written for her because Dee is the founder. You want to wave that, Dee?
She
brought along Conservation Magazine and the executive editor. So you can also hit her up, press the flesh, give her your card because it's a really, Dee views this as the New Yorker of conservation. And she wants the brightest and the best writing. So that's you. Next, we have Marcia McNutt. Marcia is a pioneer in many ways. She has led many deep sea expeditions as the chief scientist. Before she came here, she was at the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Research Institute, MBARI. And now, as you know, likely, she is the director of USGS. And she's here to talk to us, too, about what she knows, what she's seen, and the future. And our first speaker will be Jane Lubchenco. Jane is, as many of you know, a person who has always championed the importance of scientists speaking and engaging with society at a broader level. And this started from the early days when she was president of AAAS, and she has led many, many efforts, and now she is walking her talk as the chief administrator for NOAA. So, Jane, if you would start with 2 minutes telling us what you think we should know about ocean acidification.
Morning, everybody. Nancy and Jeff, thank you very much for convening this panel. Many of you have heard that oceans have become 30% more acidic over the last century, and that this massive change in ocean chemistry is beginning to have serious impacts, and it's likely to get worse. Most people, though, have never heard of ocean acidification. I would suggest that it's arguably the most important underreported global environmental story today. One impact of OA is on animals and plants that have hard parts, shells or skeletons made of calcium carbonate or chalk, such as corals, oysters, crabs, and many tiny plants of the sea. OA makes it harder for those plants and animals to make and to keep their hard parts, and therefore it's often called osteoporosis of the sea. But it's not only the affected species that are at risk, it's the people, it's the other species that depend on them for habitat or for a food source. As problematic as this osteoporosis is expected to be, it's far from the full story, however. Scientists are discovering that OA also affects basic physiology of many ocean denizens, from their sense of smell to reproduction. Two quick stories. Oregon and Washington are ground zero for OA. Oysters have already been affected. Hatcheries that support a $110 million West Coast shellfish industry were on the verge of collapse just a few years ago due to an unprecedented mysterious die-off of their larvae. The culprit turned out to be corrosive, acidified water that was being upwelled from the deep ocean, killing those larvae. OA monitoring now alerts growers to upwelling conditions, allowing recovery of this industry for now. Second, researchers in Australia discovered that OA makes it difficult for clownfish, think Nemo, to avoid bigger fish that are coming to prey on them. Instead of diving into the tentacles of their anemone, clownfish in acidified water actually swim toward their predators. Think about antelopes swimming toward lions that are running toward lions that are chasing them. Not a very good survival strategy. So stories of mysteries, surprises, new discoveries, and heroes abound in the hidden world of ocean acidification, from Papua New Guinea to the Arctic, from salmon and king crab to coral reefs and sea butterflies, from fishermen and oyster growers to young scientists and industry partners and more. And with ocean chemistry changing faster than any time in the last 25 million years, this is a dynamic, unfolding story. I invite you to jump in.
Jane, over to you, Steve.
So, Jane, what else does this affect? I mean, there must be synergies involved here. If there's been a 30% increase in acidification in the oceans, what else is going on?
Well, ocean acidification is interacting with other stressors that are happening in the oceans. And in fact, ocean acidification is worse in local coastal areas if there is runoff of nutrients, runoff of carbon dioxide, especially nitrogen pollution. So that what's happening globally can be even worse in a local sense. But ocean acidification is also interacting with increases in water temperature, for example. And some of the laboratory studies that have been done, for example, with baby sea urchins, suggest that the larvae can accommodate to more acidified water or more temperature, but they die if they're exposed to both. So there are interactions between this change in ocean chemistry and the other changes that are happening globally.
So what's to be done, and do you, as head of NOAA, do you have the resources to help us address that?
What's to be done? I think there are both local as well as global things that can be done. Reducing stressors that interact with OA actually are a really good strategy. And that's reducing flow of nutrients to the sea. It's not introducing potentially invasive species. It's addressing overfishing. But in the end, what we really need to do is reduce carbon emissions. This is a new unfolding story. There's a lot that we don't know. And so having more information about how ocean acidification is going to affect so many different species. A few species benefit, most do not. We need to understand those trade-offs. We need to be monitoring because it's not happening uniformly every place. There's some places like the West Coast where it's playing out first. And so having a better understanding of the patterns and the likely impacts is important. Do we have enough resources to do it? Absolutely not. We're making the best with what we have, and with the downward pressure on everybody's budgets, it's going to be increasingly challenging to invest in both the research and the monitoring. Fortunately, there are a lot of fishermen that are very concerned about this, want to partner with us to do joint research. There are a lot of industry partners that are developing new technologies to help us do better sensing out in the ocean. But it's a huge challenge. It's not going to go away. It's one we need to be paying more attention to. And it would actually help, frankly, if more people were aware that the problem even existed.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jane and Steve. Marcia.
Yes, thank you very much. Story I want to talk about today is the importance of also telling the public about good news stories about the ocean. I think that with all of the concern about the pressures on the ocean, about overfishing, about nutrient loading, about plastics in the ocean, about ocean acidification that Jane's just spoken about so eloquently, sometimes the public gets concerned and they throw their hands up in the air and they say, all is lost. What can we do? The oceans are irrevocably harmed, and there's nothing that I, as an individual, can do. And the message I want to leave you with today is that all is not lost. There is actually a lot that can be done to save our oceans. And in particular, I want to talk about coastal restoration. It turns out that the coastal zone is only 13% of our land area, and yet it gives us 40% of our jobs. A recent study that was done shows, an economic study, shows that for every $1 million that is invested in coastal restoration creates 20 to 30 jobs. And that is more than is created by investing in the oil and gas industry, or that is invested in by investing in construction. And so by investing in coastal restoration, that's a job creator in addition to all of the long-term benefits in things like ecosystem services and the long-term benefits to the ocean and to the planet that are also accrued. So we can take action to fix these problems. It's not too late. And the important thing also is that there's a lot of great science that's being done at the USGS and at other federal agencies that are underpinning these coastal restoration jobs. Everything from understanding how the coastal zone is helping to protect communities from storms, how the coastal zone can be enhanced to provide better habitat for fisheries, and other important things that the coastal zone can be done to improve ecosystem services.
Dirk.
A concrete example of what you just said. concrete example where it might work and whom you had to win over to get it going?
Yes, there are a number of great examples. Let me give you one unusual example from the West Coast, from the California Bay Delta. The California Bay Delta, between the Sacramento and the San Joaquin rivers, is one of the West Coast's most important estuaries. It provides drinking water for millions of Californians. It provides agricultural water for one of the world's most important economies. And due to poor land use practices, that whole area has subsided as much as 25 feet, such that if you stand right now in the California Bay Delta, levees hold back the rivers such that ships now go above your head. The USGS scientists have shown that by changing land use practices and by doing carbon farming on that land, they have actually been able to raise the level of these subsided lands such that over the years, the carbon farming has raised the land every year by sequestering plant material in the soil and above the current level of the land such that the land surface rises and CO2 is sequestered underground, and the amount of carbon that is sequestered in the soil is staggering. It is equivalent to taking every SUV, if all of the subsided land were turned into carbon farms, it would be equivalent to taking every SUV in the state of California and converting it to a small hybrid.
Sounds great. We have a lot of peatland restoration ideas in Europe as well, and we have a carbon market to pay for it. Nevertheless, it has not really kicked off. What is the major obstacle there? Why don't farmers go for it? How can you convince them to go for it?
Well, of course, this is a major policy issue in this country. There are several things that could help make this happen. One thing would be if we had actually a market for carbon. But I think another thing, too, is to raise everyone's awareness to the other ecosystem services that could be supplied by this kind of change in land use practice. And one thing that we are working on in the USGS and other areas of the federal government is a more all-encompassing study of ecosystem services and how land use contributes to ecosystem services.
Does everybody know what ecosystem services are?
Okay.
Quickly, because I think our time is just about up, but I think it is an important thing for you to clarify.
Okay. Ecosystem services is a way of accounting for the way that we know how we can, in a financial market, understand how we might account for the value of something that is freely traded. But we know in the natural world there's a certain amount of capital that is created. For example, in the California Bay Delta, how would we account for the value of a piece of land in terms of its ability to provide clean water and fresh air? Those would be ecosystem services that might be supplied by the California Bay Delta, habitat for spawning fish. All of those would be examples of ecosystem services that could be supplied by the California Bay Delta that could be enhanced by better land use practices.
And this is a huge area in marine science today. It's actually quantifying and putting figures on this so that you actually can start dealing in real numbers in the world. Thanks very much, Marcia. Okay, Dee, tell us how it is really. Dee spends much of her time in the farthest corners of the world, as she'll tell you.
Long-term studies, as you all know, are really rare. And the reason that they're rare is because government doesn't fund long-term studies, and nor does almost anybody else. But those are the critical kinds of studies that we need to be able to know what's happening to our planet. Now, I'm supposed to tell you something new, so first I'll tell you something old, and that is we all know the planet is changing. But I've spent the last 40 years of my life studying penguins, and the penguins have demonstrated to me that all of the changes at the IPCC, the International Panel for Climate Change, have already been happening for a long time. The two major predictions is that the world is going to warm, of course, because of CO2. We've already talked about some of the problems with CO2. And also that we're going to have increased variability. Now, you might not worry about that, but if you lived in Germany or in France, and you were there in 2003 and 2006, and your grandmother died from heat stroke, you might be a little more concerned. Or if you were in Katrina's wake, in New Orleans, or in some of the places this past year that we've had tornadoes for the first time in the U.S. Variability is here. And from the viewpoint of penguins, it's been here for a long time. And what I'm talking about in terms of variability for penguins, at this my study site at Punta Tombo, Argentina, from 1960 to 2000, we've seen rainfall increase significantly. We've also seen storms of more than 20 millimeters increase, and the amount of rain that those storms drop is also significantly increased. Now, what does that mean to a penguin? It means that they're living in swimming pools when they have chicks and eggs, and they don't like to live in swimming pools because if their chicks get wet, and it's cold particularly, they die. Now, Argentina is not that cold, but when it gets hot, it's also a problem for penguins. So last year, when it got to 96 degrees, we had 22 penguins that dropped over dead in the middle of the colony. But imagine if you were in a wetsuit in 96 degree weather. You probably would drop over from heat stroke too. So climate variability is already affecting penguins. We're also seeing at Punta Tombo that they're going further. So using satellite tags, we now know that over the last decade, they're going 25 miles further from their nest while their mate is sitting on the nest. That may not sound bad, but imagine that you have a job in Chicago and suddenly you're transferred to St. Louis. You have to pay the increased cost of travel, and it means that you're away from your family more. So for penguins, it means they got to pay that extra 50 kilometers of cost, and their mate, unlike your spouse, is starving while they're gone. So that's really tough. What I've seen over the last 30 years is that egg-laying dates are now about every decade 3 days later. So they're laying their eggs 9 days later than when I started working at Punta Tombo. Those are real effects on penguins. And it's not only Magellanic penguins. I've been working in the Galapagos Islands off and on for about 40 years. And the Galapagos is affected by increased frequencies of these El Niño and La Niña events. Right now we know we're in a La Niña event. It was predicted that we will have a La Niña event this last year. That's one of the reasons I went to see how well the penguins are doing, because in La Niña events, there's more food. The water's cold. There's plenty of things for penguins to eat. When I went down there in February, the water temperatures were 87 degrees Fahrenheit. That's bathwater temperature. Penguins do not like bathwater temperature, and the reason they don't is because there's no food in it. So boobies were actually dying because they couldn't find enough food. That's the kind of variability that penguins are trying to live with. Now, I would contend that penguins do better with environmental variability than humans do. But we're making so many changes in our globe, we have to be careful in the sense that we have now 7 billion people. We don't write about that very often, but in the 1960s, there were only 3 billion. So in many of your lifetimes, we've more than doubled population. So that's another thing that is going on. And of course, what do people want to do? Consume. And in some case, they want to consume small fish. Now, penguins like small fish too. So if we're going to eat small fish, I say eat your sardines and eat the anchovies, but don't turn them into fish meal, because that's not the best use for those small fish. We need to feed marine predators, and one of those are penguins. So if you're going to use sardines and anchovies, eat them yourself. Don't feed them to farm-raised salmon or to farm animals like pigs and chickens. So what does all of that mean before Nancy pulls me off? Wrap it up, she says. And that is that we can, only humans can make wise decisions for penguins and for us. And that's important as individuals as well as society, because we need to help government make the right decisions. And that will be good for penguins.
Over to you, Andy.
So what I would love to know is what drives a young girl from Michigan to, what is it that drives your passion about penguins specifically?
Well, I just fell in love with them. I mean, how could you not like penguins? They walk upright, they're comical, they look like they're intelligent even though they're not very.
Yeah.
But they can remember things for long periods of time like parrots. So I don't know. I just find them endearing, and I think that people can pay attention to penguins. So they're marine sentinels. They're really environmental sentinels telling us what's going on. And many times we can't seem to pay attention to humans. So I'm hopeful that maybe penguins can give us insights into behaving better for all the rest of the species on the planet.
Now, I'm going to ask a question about the magazine that you founded. Why do you need us?
Well, we need you for writers, number one.
Okay.
And number two, because often the messages, particularly environmental messages, get lost. Climate change, I don't understand where that goes away to sometimes, but it appears that we like to have balanced reporting. And we know that it's very hard to find somebody that doesn't believe in climate change. But you guys always find them because of balance. And I want to get more of that truth out there so we can know what we should be worried about and what we can do about it. And there are really a lot of things that individuals as well as government and NGOs can do. But we as individuals have to help them. And so you guys, we need you to write for Conservation Magazine, as well as to tell your friends about it, because we think that this is going to be the touchstone to get conservation science out to not only scientists, but to a broader audience.
Is there a Twitter feed for the magazine? Just one quick.
Yes, there is, but I have yet to tweet. Some of us are just Luddites by nature.
Thank you both. Becky.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pick up where Dee left off and tell what I think is a new story about an old story. And that old story is overfishing. And what's different is that when you think about overfishing, you probably think about depleted fisheries like Atlantic cod or bluefin tuna. But emerging science indicates that a rather insidious type of overfishing is actually for fish that people typically do not eat. And these are nevertheless fish that play a big role in food production, especially as the world population is increasing, the 7 billion number that we just heard about. And affluence is growing, especially in Asia, and people want to eat more animal protein. So the fish that I'm speaking of are so-called forage fish. These are small fish like anchovies and sardines and menhaden that are the foundation of marine food webs. They're critical food for many marine predators. And human demand for these forage fish is booming. Prices for one of the key products made from forage fish have gone up fourfold since 2000. And that's because these fish are used as ingredients in animal feed, the stuff that we use to grow animals to grow more animal protein for this growing and increasingly affluent human population. Now, some of this feed is for traditional livestock and poultry, but an increasing fraction of it is for farm fish, which are commonly fed fish because, frankly, many of them eat fish in the world. Yet paradoxically, taking too many of these small fish can result in fewer wild fish for human consumption. And that's because forage fish left in the ocean are critical food, not just for penguins, but also for many of the larger predatory marine fish that you and I like to eat. So you take the forage fish out, not only you have fewer penguins, fewer seals, but you also have fewer bigger predatory fish. Sharks? Well, that would be one example, yes. But other fish are for example, closer to home would be striped bass here along the East Coast. So I would argue that we can have our fish and eat them too, but we've got to change the way we fish. And emerging science suggests we've got to fish about half as hard for these forage fish. We also have to make some changes to farming practices, and particularly to aquaculture, and quit growing some of these fish that eat vast amounts of forage fish, because they're diverting the fish from marine systems into a food supply designed for the affluent. You want to, such as, well, an example would be farmed salmon. Thank you.
I'm very curious about how we could leave more fish out there for wildlife when demand keeps going up. By most projections, it seems like we're going to have to double food production in the next 40 years. And so how do you get out of this box with increasing demand? And you said we could have our fish and eat it too. It seems like we've already had them and eaten them, you know, mostly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you look at the sardine fishery out of Monterey, I mean, it's pretty much gone. And, you know, Cannery Row is now a tourist trap. And the Menhaden schools, you know, are all been ground up into fertilizer. So I how do you get out of this box? I'm sort of curious.
Well, getting out of the box involves two things. It involves technology and it involves changing farming practices. And in the case of leaving more small fish in the ocean, one can grow many types of livestock, such as pigs and chickens, which are major users of small fish now in their feed, simply without these fish. The fish are fed to pigs and chickens because they're nice sources of high-quality animal protein, but they're not essential to their diets. In the case of fish farming, the situation is rather more complicated because many fish, as I said, naturally consume fish, and bigger predatory fish, such as salmon, actually need some of the oils in farm fish nutritionally in order to grow and thrive. So there are a number of folks who are pursuing alternative feed ingredients that are a way of providing food to farm fish that's high in these essential fatty acids. Innovations range from feeding algae to people are playing around with genetically engineered soybeans to changing diets and all sorts of other ways. So technology is part of the solution. The other part of the solution is how people change their preferences for fish. We can farm fish like salmon. We can farm fish like a tilapia or a catfish or, in Asia, a carp, which really requires very little fish meal or fish oil. These are the ingredients made from small fish in their diets and therefore get a lot more bang from our buck out of these small fish.
So Dee had mentioned that she thought we should start eating anchovies, I guess, as opposed to the inefficient way of feeding other animals that we eat. I can barely stand anchovies on pizza. Do you think we can change our... You'll have them. Okay. Do you think we could change our way we think about anchovies?
Well, I think we can change our way we think about a lot of fish. When you look at people's taste in fish, it's exceedingly plastic. I mean, many of the fish we find on American plates today weren't there a couple decades ago. No one had heard of them. You know, skate wings were trash. Monkfish were trash. And yet they became delicacies because as certain sorts of fish became depleted, people turned to these alternatives and started consuming them. And so my sense is that people will be willing to eat a lot of different sorts of fish, and certainly one very efficient use of forage fish, rather than feeding them to animals at all, is actually to consume them directly. And there is an effort now to do this in Peru, which has the largest forage fish fishery in the world. It's about 8% of the world's annual fisheries landings, and some very energetic folks in Peru now have about 2% of those fisheries landings. That's only it's a very small number, but a significant amount of fish, because the fishery is so huge, used for direct consumption in Peru, which is a very poor country. So you know, I think there is room for some change.
Okay, thank you all. Let's turn it over to you and let you dig a little deeper on any of these topics that have been touched upon. So anybody who wants to, come up to the microphone.
Seth, take it first.
Yes, thank you. Seth Borenstein, Associated Press. More on the communications end instead of the ocean science, if you don't mind. And forgive me, this may take a second or two to preface the three questions I have.
Only one.
It's one question for all three, for three people. Is just the transition from being an excellent communicator to not communicating when in the administration of the federal government. So this would be actually because for Dr. McNutt, somehow during the BP oil spill, USGS continued to communicate. You continued to communicate. I'm wondering how you bucked the pressure from the Obama administration to not communicate. For Dr. Lubchenco, you were an excellent communicator when you were an ocean scientist. You've been an excellent communicator after the spill, before the spill. During the spill, you and Noah were far from being good communicators. And finally, for Dr. John Holdren, who was an excellent communicator beforehand, who doesn't even communicate anymore and is not here once again, despite invitations, why does he just stop? So that's what I'm wondering.
Oh, I'd like to hear that.
I'll let either of our agency scientists step up to this one.
So, Seth, I'm not accepting your premise, not surprisingly. I believe that... So individual scientists are obviously speaking for themselves. A scientist who is the head of an agency needs to be speaking as a member, has a different responsibility to be sort of extra careful in making sure that what you're saying is absolutely accurate because people are acting on that information. And throughout Deepwater Horizon, our intent was to say what we knew, when we knew it, as soon as we were certain that it was accurate. In other words, not to speculate, not to hypothesize, but to simply present information that we were sure of, so that it could guide the response. The response effort during Deepwater Horizon was immense. It was an incredible effort that is very difficult for anybody who wasn't sort of right in the middle of it to appreciate all of the dimensions. We set up mechanisms to ensure that we were getting information to a variety of people as the event was playing out in all of its dimensions. We had daily calls with governors. We had press conferences every day. We had daily briefings on the Hill. What we didn't do as well in hindsight that we should have done was to have better mechanisms to communicate the science of what we knew to the scientific community, because they had no way of getting information except through what they heard or read from the press. And that was oftentimes wrong or insufficient to really give them what they wanted. And so one of the tensions that played out, in my view, during the spill was scientists outside of government making statements without knowledge of what we in the government knew, not because we didn't tell them or couldn't tell them or didn't want to, but because the ways of communicating to the public didn't provide the richness that the scientists wanted to truly understand. And I remember very vividly one of the first conferences we convened in Baton Rouge with the academic community and others, where we were saying, what do we actually know? What's the information that we have? No constraints on what we could say and share. And I had about 50 people come up to me afterwards saying, I had no idea that you had that information. Now, much of it was on the website, hard to find, yes, and that was sort of one of the things we worked out during the spill, was having a single platform to post data and information. But one of the challenges with a spill like that is that there was this insatiable demand for information at a very superficial level that got in the way of communicating more of the substance, more of the details, more of the nuances that scientists wanted to know and hear about. So that's one of the lessons for me about the spill, the need to have ways to get information at a variety of levels to all the players who actually are interested in information. We were not muzzled. We were not, the administration was interested in having, getting information out as much as we could, but having everybody in the government understand all the different pieces that were in play. I had daily phone calls, if not in-person meetings, with the other principals, which were the National Incident Commander, Thad Allen, Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, Administrator VPA, Lisa Jackson, Carol Browner for the White House, Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano. We met, and oftentimes intermittently, the Secretary of Energy, Steve Chu, and we met daily, sometimes twice a day, to trade information on what was going on.
So, Jane?
Yep.
We've got a lot of people lined up. Maybe just a closing thought on how things are going to go better in the future and what you're doing about that.
Yep. So, one of the challenges that we had during the spill was that many NOAA scientists were operating under a previous policy of a previous administration that in order to talk to the public or the press about their science, they had to get permission. And early in my tenure, I made a commitment to create a new scientific integrity policy that was stimulated by the president's executive order on scientific integrity. John Holdren, as science advisor, has also participated in this process. And each agency has developed its scientific integrity policy. We have not yet, we are close to releasing our final new scientific integrity policy, the first one ever. And one of the things that it will say is that scientists at NOAA are able to speak to anyone about their science without getting permission. So that's a major accomplishment, and I think is a step in absolutely the right direction. So new scientific integrity policy, watch for it coming soon.
David.
Yeah, first to correct Jeff.
And if you could introduce yourself.
David Hargan, author, and correcting Jeff. We're obviously not into the meat and potatoes or into the fish and chips of this conference at this point. And just briefly, when I was down in the Gulf last summer, everybody was pretty much frustrated with everybody in terms of dealing with Coast Guard, NOAA, scientists, fishermen. And I'd like to say that, that people generally were not frustrated with USGS. I think that you did a great job on the ground that was unacknowledged. Mm-hmm. And I also agree that solutions are great. I think everyone should read 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. But, Marsha, you really scared me on ocean acidification a few years ago when you talked about its impacts on oxygen in the ocean and what it might mean in terms of the world's largest animal migration, vertical movements of fish in the ocean. And we like solutions, but we like scary stories even more. So you tell that.
Is there a question in that?
Yes, about the oxygen, how ocean acidification is going to affect the oxygen and the upwelling zones.
Yes. Okay, David, you remind me about the scary stories. And here's the issue that is particularly important for places which are widespread in the ocean, where there are large oxygen minimum zones, and animals basically need to migrate across these oxygen minimum zones in order to do their daily migrations. And these oxygen-breathing organisms, as they move across them, what happens with the increasing depletion of oxygen as OA continues is that the depletion, the interaction of OA with the chemistry of the ocean expands the oxygen minimum zone. And in places like Monterey Bay, where I spent much of my career, the concern is that many of these animals will get to the point where they will not be able to complete this diurnal migration. And what these animals do is they hide during the daytime down in the dark regions of the ocean, so they do not, where they will not be preyed on, and they come up in the nighttime to feed. And if the zone of oxygen depletion gets so large that they can't breathe through it because the oxygen levels are so low, they will not be able to complete that diurnal migration. And some people like Bruce Robeson and other scientists who are experts in these soft-bodied organisms that complete this migration are concerned that that might be a threat in the future.
Susan.
Hi there. I'm Susan Moran, freelance print and radio and pretty much whatever else journalist in Boulder, Colorado. So a question about the bottom or close to the bottom of the food chain, a not so charismatic one, but the krill. We heard Wednesday night from Kim Bernard at Palmer Station about the role of the depleted krill in the Western Antarctic Peninsula and its effect on adelies and other penguins and stuff. So I'm wondering, you mentioned that sardines, anchovies are a problem. How clear is the science on krill? I mean, I know it's measured in they're measured in tons, and there's still a bunch of them, but some concern about whether there should be fishing down there at all for krill, but especially for aquaculture and especially for the emerging, you know, omega-3 market for human consumption. I think Whole Foods stopped selling or decided not to sell because they said the jury's out still, not out on the science. But what does the science tell us, and should there be fishing? And for that matter, should there be eco-labels for krill and others for aquaculture markets?
All right. Well, maybe Dee and I should share the answer to that question, because it's partly about penguins.
I know. You do the krill is really more your bailiwick.
Okay. Yeah.
Shrimp.
Right. The answer to your question about krill is that the main problem or the main concern is about local depletion of krill. In other words, if you take You can look at the global population of krill. There are actually a bunch of species, and you can say there are a lot of krill out there. But if you take too many krill from one area, then you can deprive predators of food who can't move so far. And this is a particular problem for creatures like adelie penguins, in the example you heard about, because if they're on an ice floe or the ice pack, they can't necessarily go infinitely far out to sea to get their food and back every day. So, you know, concerns about local depletion are very real. There seems to be a story there with penguins and Antarctica. And it's a concern that really has to be built into management of these bottom of the food chain sorts of fish, whether they're fish like krill or sardines or anchovies or menhaden.
So let me just say that krill or shrimp. And the thing that's really unusual about these kinds of shrimp is that they have a really long life cycle. They can live for 6 or 7 years. The problem, again, is this increased environmental variability. They have to have a good year to be able to recruit. And they haven't had a good year to recruit. So from a penguin's viewpoint, if there's not any krill there, what am I going to eat? Now, fortunately, penguins are pretty opportunistic. So they'll eat ice fish or anything else that they can get that's smaller than their head that they can get their bill on. But the problem is, if we take all these forage fish, we're going to have huge effects on the ocean. We're already seeing those. But on the coast of Peru, by taking all those anchovies out, Evelyn J. Hutchinson, a famous ecologist, estimated that there were probably 100 million seabirds that lived in Peru. Now there's about 4 million. We're living in a very depleted environment. And I guess my sense is it's going to become more depleted as long as we're going to get more people. Now, technology is going to help us, but there's 7 billion people in the world, and we don't talk about that problem. But it's a real problem, just like many of the other ones that we have, like education, etc. But we're not doing much about many of these problems. And we cannot wait much longer if we care about the other things that are in the world.
Andy.
I'd love to follow up on something that Becky... that was mentioned very briefly earlier, which was omega-3 in soy. In other words, if we can engineer soybeans and then modify how we cultivate soy so it's more sustainable, don't all these issues go away? Because you can have a feedstock for a fish meal that... And this gets to these trade-off issues that just aren't adequately explored by the environmental community. You know, if you're for krill and anchovies and penguins, you should be for omega-3 soybeans. Or not.
Or not, right.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. I can tell you a bit more. I haven't been following biotechnology developments closely.
Actually, let me just frame it a different way. Is that more off the table than it should be in discussions?
That's a very good question. Genetic engineering is obviously very controversial. It's arguably not adequately regulated, particularly in the U.S., you know, how foods are looked at before they enter the food supply. And it's a very powerful technology, potentially, to change the way plants produce various chemicals in their tissue. My response would be the issue of genetically engineering soybeans to produce omega-3 fatty acids that can potentially be used in feed is one that deserves a lot of discussion.
Well, it already exists.
It exists. It's not marketed.
Right.
So a lot of big companies have been chasing that as sort of one of the holy grails for genetic engineering.
What's your personal opinion?
my personal opinion is we ought to look a lot more closely at them and then make some intelligent decisions, but I wouldn't want to take it off the table for sure. It's not such an easy thing to achieve. A lot of the very early genetic engineering, in fact, most of it to date, is very simplistic. You simply take a gene that codes for a particular protein, because genes code for proteins, and insert it in a plant, and you get a new trait. The typical trait will be insect resistance, because you can put a pesticidal protein into plants. But when you start engineering a plant to change its synthesis, its biochemical synthesis of the oils, the lipids in the plant, so it produces more what are called omega-3 fatty acids instead of omega-6 fatty acids, which they typically produce, then you're really mucking around with the plant chemistry in a much bigger way, how the plant functions. And so you get yourself into some complicated situations. And I said I have not closely been following the developments in this area in recent years, but I would argue that these sorts of changes with genetic engineering need a lot of scrutiny before we were to adopt them on a very wide scale.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Rich Blasting, freelance environmental journalist. Thanks very much for an interesting panel. I have a question about the Arctic sea ice, the surface ice, greatly diminished, and this is at a level of about 390 ppm parts per million greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, international goal of 450, although it could be modified. Is that sea ice permanently gone? Is that the assessment? I've heard an advocacy argument, you know, 350 maybe because it's a short-term feedback. And what's the proper lesson about the Arctic sea ice? It seems the lesson policy, the governmental response is the race is on, resources, sea lanes are open, and what are the proper lessons learned?
What could you just really simply try to restate the question in?
Oh, what's the state of sea ice?
For the microphone, it's hard to hear you.
I'm sorry, thank you. The sea ice, Arctic, at 390 ppm parts per million greenhouse gases, irreversible, and if so, what's the proper lesson? The seasonal sea ice.
Does anybody want to take that on?
So I'm still not quite sure what you're asking. Sea ice extent in the Arctic Ocean, you know, changes seasonally. This year, it's among the lowest ever recorded. So the sea ice that has been lost in the summertime, some of that will reform during the wintertime. So it's an annual cycle of shrinking and growing. But the new ice that is reforming is often thinner. It's annual ice as opposed to multi-year ice. And so through time, we're seeing not only less ice in the summertime, but more ice that doesn't have the three-dimensional structure that is important for a lot of the animals that use sea ice during the fall and winter and spring. That sea ice is melting at a faster rate than was predicted. There's a lot of interest in and study about exactly what's causing that. It seems to be an interaction between what's happening in the atmosphere and what's happening with warmer ocean that is melting that sea ice faster. That is in turn causing a lot of changes in the Arctic, both the Arctic ecosystems. There are long time lags in this system, and so the path that we are on in terms of producing more and more carbon emissions will only exacerbate this problem. We don't know if it is completely reversible or not because of the feedback loops in that system. But I think it is yet another argument for reducing carbon emissions as fast as possible so that we could hopefully avoid some of the more catastrophic consequences. And we're already beginning to see many of those play out.
Just can we follow up on a moment on that? You talk about the feedback mechanisms. What are we seeing in the high Arctic in related to Arctic ice? And are we into a feedback loop there already?
So yes, there are interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean that we are seeing play out, and that may be one reason it's happening faster, it's melting faster than was originally predicted. So we are seeing that, and it has some very real consequences, not only to polar bears and ice seals, but to the ice fish that live in the ice and to a lot of the microscopic plants, the plankton, that are now exposed to more sunlight than if the ice was covering it. So it's changing the fundamental structure of a lot of Arctic ecosystems in the water and above the water. And this is a very dynamic situation.
And are we getting more CO2 as a function of this?
We are. Those dynamics are not completely understood in terms of what's happening from the ocean. So let me just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have quite a few people who still have questions. Over to you.
Hi, Curtis Brainerd, Columbia Journalism Review, and sorry to digress again from ocean issues, but I just want to pick up where Seth left off, although frame the question a little bit more generally. At CJR, we just did a survey of roughly 400 journalists, science journalists around the country, who expressed almost unanimous frustration with ongoing transparency and access concerns under the Obama administration. And I tried for weeks and months to get various members of the administration to respond without success. And so my question for the members of the administration here is, you know, do you think that this administration has lived up to its promises, which it made on day one and made very vociferously about opening up an unprecedented era of, you know, openness in government? So do you think the administration has lived up to its promises? And does it concern you that so many journalists still feel so frustrated by a lack of access under this administration?
So, you know, it's really hard to speak for other agencies, but as far as NOAA is concerned, our scientists, you know, I told you about our scientific integrity policy, and that, in fact, has been in place for a number of months. So that, I mean, you should not be having trouble gaining access to NOAA scientists. But there may be something else that is operating here, and it may relate in part to Seth's question. I think there's a lot of confusion about what we know and what we're able to talk about with respect to the impact of Deepwater Horizon as it relates to the legal case under the natural resource damage assessment process. And I think this is worth describing to you all because there's a huge amount of confusion about it. Very quickly, we are in the process. The federal government is in the process of building a case against the responsible parties to take them to court and get the most damages recovered to do the restoration that's needed. Part of building that court case is to assemble information, but typically in a court case, you don't tell the person on the other side of the case what you know, because that tips your hand and lessens the likelihood that your case will be successful.
Yeah, I'm sorry, can I just interject? I'm really not asking so much about the Gulf oil spill in this case, but as a member of this administration, do you feel that it has, in general, lived up to the promises it made on day one to make this the most transparent administration in history?
So I can tell you at NOAA, we have been more transparent than ever before. Our data are on websites. Scientists can talk. People have open access to our information and our knowledge. And we have made an extraordinary concerted effort to be open, not about just about what we know, but about how we go about our business. I think that we have made some. I'm very proud of the changes that we have implemented, and that there is a lot more transparency than has ever been the case.
Marcia?
I can't speak for other agencies.
At the USGS, we were the first agency to get out the new scientific integrity policy. Ours has been in place for more than a year. I think we have an advantage at the USGS. We're just a science agency. We don't do any policy. We don't manage anything. I think that it's been business as usual at the USGS. But I think for that reason, nothing's changed for us. But I do think that there's been a little bit more friction maybe with the department because of extra pressures they may feel. Because of all the extra things that have been going on, starting with the Gulf oil spill, that have been continuing on. And we're lucky that we sort of skate under the radar.
I'm just going to say one thing here, is that you're actually talking to two scientists who left fabulous lives, you know, getting about the world, doing real science in the world, to try to change the system from within. And, so I think that this is an incredibly important topic that we all feel frustration with.
But these two people sitting here before you are doing their damnedest and really doing service because they really believe in what you're trying to do and because they really care about making science matter. And we're just about ready to wrap up here, so we have one more question.
Hi, Kathy Florsheim, freelance photographer. My question is for Dee. You raised the issue of population. You and Lester Brown are about the only people talking about that. It's the elephant in the room. How do we get past the religious fanatics who refuse to deal with this as an issue?
I guess my real interest is in science. And I guess I was on one of these shock radio programs once. It was worse than my general exams. But the guy called up and he said, I understand that you study penguins and you're worried about global warming because it affects penguins. He says, I don't believe in global warming. And I said, you can believe whatever you want. You can believe how many angels dance on the head of the pin. But that's not science. And that's one of my frustrations is I don't want balanced reporting when it comes to science. I want people to know that 90% are on this side and 10 over here, or 2, you know, versus 100%, whatever it might be. But I think we've got to do better in terms of our journalism and being able to tell the science stories, and that's important.